Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of the mindsrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today it's good to be speaking with Jeremiah Allen, who is a Christian entrepreneur currently living in Belize and indeed a long-time listener to TMR. And I shall just read from his short bio. Jeremiah is a 41-year-old former US Army soldier and Iraqi war veteran, that's 2004 to 2005. After leaving military service, he worked as a computer network security expert for the US Missile Defense Agency in 2013. He left his lucrative career and relocated his wife and two children to pursue ministry in Belize as an entrepreneur. Jeremiah is passionate about Jesus and sharing the good news with others by living out the Great Commission in everyday life. Fantastic words to start with. Jeremiah, thank you ever so much for coming on the program. Good to be speaking with you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be on your show.
It's great to have you on the show, and thank you very much for offering to come on. I mean, there's something I would like to know before we sort of get going properly is you've been listening to TMR for quite a long time. How did you come by it? Do you remember?
Yeah, I do. It was introduced to me via the Corbett Report podcast. Ah. James Corbett, he recommended you with great enthusiasm. And the very first show that I listened to, I don't remember which episode it was excellent. Well, I suppose it was the one with James Corbett. So, that's how I found your show. And I've been a huge fan ever since.
Oh, thank you very much. Presumably that was the one with the anatomy of the New World Order, was it? I think that was the one that he liked that interview. I enjoyed that interview as well.
That's correct.
Yeah, great. Yep. Oh, well, thanks for sticking with TMR for all this time. That's wonderful, because that was back in, I think, 2013, something like that. Okay. Well, people will be no doubt wondering what the conversation is going to be today. Well, we're going to be chatting around two or three main things, really. Three focal points for our conversation based upon the email exchanges that we've had talking about the possibility of this conversation. I think it's going to be quite interesting, actually. Those three things are your testimony. Now, some people will be thinking immediately, oh, here we go, it's another testimony, oh, how I came to know the Lord and all that sort of thing. But, well, maybe that could be part of it. But what we both mean here is in a broader sense. So not your conversion testimony, but rather your testimony in a broader sense of how you believe God has been dealing with you and your family over the last 10 to 20 years or so, which will be interesting in itself, but may have implications for us in a message kind of way, which is what I'm hoping is going to come out of the conversation. So that's the first thing, your testimony in its broader sense. But then also what you call in your videos, and no doubt we'll talk about your videos and your vlog, what you call in your videos disruptions. Okay, so physical disruptions, psychological, political, spiritual disruptions of all kinds, disruptions to the normal way of being that most of us, you know, we all in some way or other, we have our normal way of being, and that can be disrupted. And then thirdly, as you say, a kind of response to those disruptions, how we might prepare ourselves. How should we prepare? Should we prepare ourselves? Do we just let these things happen? Your testimony indicates, I think, some helpful possible answers, some guidance even in these times, these difficult times at the moment, and maybe even more difficult to come. We shall see. So potentially there a lot to talk about. So hopefully it will be a helpful conversation. Can I start then with this testimony in this broader sense of God's dealings with you? So to get into this, you mentioned that you were a soldier in the US Army. You were involved in the Iraq War, which, of course, immediately strikes me as necessarily disruptive. Do you want to start there?
Sure. I was already married, and my wife and I, we decided that the military was a good option for me. I had not yet finished college, and they were offering the GI Bill, and this was only a couple of years after 9/11. Hmm. And there was a patriotic portion of my upbringing that influenced my decision, and I decided it was the right thing to do. Hmm. We were already Christians, and we did pray about it and felt the Lord's leading. So I joined the Army, and almost immediately after finishing training, they deployed my unit out to Iraq, and I spent a year in Baghdad. Wow. For me personally, emotionally, mentally, in every way, it was very disruptive. Hmm. The first 10 months, I would say, I handled things fairly well. But after about 10 months, I really started struggling, especially on the emotional and mental state, feelings of loneliness and despair, being away from my wife. And of course, my son was born while I was in training in the Army. And so when I left for Iraq, he was 9 months old. And when I returned, he was a year and 9 months.
Oh, yes. Yeah, very hard.
So, I held things together quite well for quite a while. But after 10 months, I remember there was just a shift and I started to just have emotional, a lot of difficulty. I was just having a hard time keeping it together, especially just missing my wife. She's my best friend, and that was really hard. Yeah.
Of course, for many people who were traumatized by what they encountered, did you have any experiences along those lines?
I thank the Lord I did not. I was never directly in a firefight. I never had to shoot anyone. So I think the Lord was really guarding me in many ways over there. I received indirect fire, so that was the closest to the action, so to speak, that I was directly. But
close enough. Indeed.
Yeah. And I had people that I knew that I lost.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you have any, during that time, did you have any sense that the war was unjustified, was illegal? Was that clear to you? Or did you, I would say, any sense of that at all?
No. When I look back now, I recognize that I was a regular watcher of Fox News propaganda, and I had swallowed the Kool-Aid, so to speak. I believed the rhetoric coming from the White House and the military that we were there to win the hearts and minds, and we were fighting for freedom and democracy and so on and so forth. And I really embraced that propaganda at that time in my life and believed we were fighting for good reasons.
Looking back at it now, do you feel you were let down by the authorities?
100%. Yeah. I feel used and deceived.
Yeah. It's shocking, isn't it? It really is shocking. I mean, how was your relationship with God affected throughout that time? I mean, you said that you had a sense that you were, that it was within your sort of life's calling to do that initially. But then with the difficulties after a year or so, did you feel closer? Did you feel less close to God? How did it affect you?
You know, when you mentioned my testimony earlier, I almost look at it as my journey, right? All of us are on a journey. And I believe that journey, when we are seeking the Lord, there are many revelations that happen, right? The Lord continues to reveal himself, and he desires for us to draw near to him. And as we seek to do that, he is going to help us to grow in so many different ways. So the time that I spent with the military, and specifically the tour that I did in Iraq, it was part of my journey that the Lord used to build my faith in him. And I can say that with absolute confidence now, looking back almost, 18 years ago. But at the time, I don't think I had a clear understanding of that, right? Hindsight's always 20/20, they say. So I still have confidence now that the Lord was carrying me along his journey because I was seeking him, although I don't believe I was fully submitted to him. And I think that's the difference that maybe we'll get into a little bit more. So, yeah, I think to be able to live through an experience like that, there's a natural tendency of the flesh to rely more on oneself and your own understanding and your own capability. And on the spiritual side, of course, the Spirit is drawing us to our Father, and he wants us to rely more on him. And that was one of those instances where that was one of the challenges. And I think I did turn to him. I remember just one example at around the 10-month mark, as I started to struggle with the emotional toll of the tour and of the isolation, I didn't have any Christian brothers or sisters that I was able to fellowship with. I went to chapel on Sundays from time to time, but it was a very superficial affair. There was no relationship with the individuals there. I didn't know anybody at the chapel, and it didn't seem like there was any desire to develop relationship there. So although in my heart I was yearning for more spiritual connection and more spiritual food, I didn't feel like I had a good opportunity for that. And around the 10-month mark, there was a day that I was receiving instruction from my superiors, and it just felt so overwhelming. And I kind of had a little bit of a emotional breakdown. And I remember walking away from my unit. I walked all the way across. I was in the green zone. So I walked to the chapel, and I sat down and just talked and prayed and cried with the chaplain there. And he prayed with me. And I just needed that intimate discipleship. And it was, I think, gave me a boost that I needed to last that last couple of months. Just to be able to sit and pray and seek the Lord's comfort in that time.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you can look back at that experience and draw that out of it now, because, you know, you said at the beginning that you felt that you were somehow called by God. You know, it was the right kind of thing to do, which could give the impression that the war in itself was kind of a righteous thing, which we know it was not. But what was at the beginning God's prompting to you? Interpreting it theologically, it was to develop you as a person and your relationship with him. It was not really about the war at all, was it? Looking back at it, it was a relationship with him that was developing in this difficult, strained way. But now you've come out of it the other end and you're so much stronger.
Well, that's right. And I think we have precedence for this, right? When we look back through history, even back in biblical times, there were good rulers and there were bad rulers, and they did good things and they did bad things. But when bad rulers were in charge, it didn't mean that God was endorsing that. He was still working in individual hearts through those tough times. The apostles' experience in the early church martyred in a horrific way, just because they were in that time and under an evil regime or so on and so forth, didn't mean that God had forgotten about them as individuals. He's drawing each one of us to him. And our journey, you know, may include things that don't serve the bigger purpose, but are the Lord's way of drawing us to him. So,
Yeah, going back to the early time when you said you felt this sense that it was the right thing to do this, were you aware that the state was employing religious language? Was there a sense of civil religion? I noticed, you know, in the emails you sent to me that you were taken with Martin Erdman's interview on civil religion in America in particular, although, you know, it goes on everywhere in different forms. Were you aware that the state was manipulating religion for such warring ends?
I was completely unaware. And I think that was part of the upbringing that I had. I think I was raised in a home that was explicitly Christian, but implicitly falling for the trap of civil religion.
Yes, very interesting. Yeah. Okay, well, you obviously left the military and you went to Japan. Why did you leave the military? Did you just have a fixed term and it came to an end?
Actually, I went to Japan with the military, it was a change of duty station. We went to Tokyo, and I was still with the military. I did originally a four-year contract, and then in order to accept the change of station to Tokyo, it required a two-year extension, and I thought that was a worthy trade-off because the unit in Japan, it was a non-deployable unit. And so there was a high likelihood that I would be able to be in Japan for 3 years with my family without the risk of another deployment. Mm-hmm. And it was the best decision I made during my military stint. But it was within the first couple of years of service that I had decided that it was not going to be a career for me. I think the military requires a lot of conformity, and you're not supposed to question the authority and whatnot. And from a young age, I'm a thinker, and I have always prided myself in thinking for myself. And I just got in trouble too much for questioning authority. I would always attempt to do that as cordially and as politely and respectfully as I could. But it didn't matter how respectful you were about it. Just the idea that you would do it was too much.
Yeah. You know, just to echo something that my dad used to say to me, he did military service here in the UK back in the whatever 50s or something like that. And they used to do what they call square bashing, you know, so march around the courtyard and that. And then they would stand in a line and he would recount with some humor how the sergeant major, you know, would come along the line and would absolutely shout right into their faces, you know, that they were anything that was not going according to the exact orders that had been given. The abuse was totally over the top. And my father used to find it strangely funny, but of course he wasn't able to smile because then he'd have got a torrent of abuse. And he told me, you know, that was all, this is why he found it funny, because he knew what was going on. It was all in order to train the troops not to think for themselves. And that's interesting that you've said that. Did you experience anything quite like that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And when I joined the military, I was 23 years old already. So I had a slightly more mature mind than most of my peers in training. Mm. And what you just described, Julian, maybe 20 years ago, I say 20 years ago, 20 years before my time, that was just the training mentality. And that's what I kind of expected joining the military, that kind of, you know, like what you see in the movies, right, with the drill sergeant yelling at the young recruits, that was kind of the training atmosphere. And then once you graduate from the training, then things would shift a bit. Mm. And so when I went into the training, I often struggled to hold back a laugh or a smile because I saw it as a game. It was a mental game. It was a And I was willing to play the game. And during that training period, I did very well. And I didn't have any problems because I was playing a game. But then once I got stationed at my first duty station and the training was over and I realized, wow, they're still playing the game. What's going on here? That's when I started to, the image that I had of what the military was started to crack in my mind. And I started to understand something's not quite right here.
Mm. So when you were in Japan, you're still working for the military. You were computer network security expert for missile defense. In your notes to me, you describe a time of overclocking. And of course, what I thought you were referring to there was that you know, it was a metaphor for yourself, that you were sort of working too hard and you were getting burnt out or something. But no, you literally mean overclocking of processors or something. What was going on with that?
Yeah, so in 2006, when I first moved to Japan, I had been a computer gamer my whole life growing up. Since I was 6 years old, my dad bought a Commodore 64, and it was the household computer, and mostly we used it for games. But when I moved to Japan, I got into the hobby of overclocking computers, and essentially that just means souping them up in some way or another, adding additional cooling mechanism or whatnot in order to run the chips, the processor, the graphics card, the memory, whatever it is, the different aspects of the computer system, higher than what the manufacturer recommends, much like people would soup up their cars. And that kind of evolved over the next couple of years.
Was that so that you could get super games with fantastic graphics going and that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's right. It was in order to, on a practical basis, to make games run faster with higher frame rates and more graphical settings turned up, right? Mm. But it evolved into something way more than practical. It evolved into a competitive side. And in 2008, I had joined a online team, and Tom's Hardware Guide, which is one of the biggest hardware computer hardware review sites online, they sponsored a overclocking competition internationally in 2008, where they got five regions around the globe together and had regional overclocking competitions happen. And it was an invitational, and we all nominated one another to be a part of this competition. Mm-hmm. So me and two others from the team, we were accepted and invited to come to Los Angeles. So I flew from Japan to Los Angeles, and we competed in the North American qualifier. And we won the North American qualifier in 2008. Hmm. And then the other regional winners from China and Italy and Germany and Taiwan and us, North America, we all gathered in Paris, France in 2008, December, where me and my two teammates, we won the world championship there.
Oh, wow.
And so over the next couple of years, I was very heavily involved. I flew around the world several times and competed in several international overclocking championships. That was the only world title, but I also won another North American championship in 2009.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
Sounds like you're having a great time by the sound of it.
It was wonderful. Yeah, it was all sponsored, and I started having lots of computer manufacturers send me hardware to do reviews, and I got into a bit of online journalism, testing hardware and writing reviews about the hardware.
You say in your notes that you were still doing this job, weren't you, at the time? You were still working for Missile Defense. But there was some experience. I don't want you to go into detail because it may go against some secrecy arrangement that you have. I don't know, agreement that you have. But there was, I think you said that there was something, maybe it was in one of your videos, that there was some piece of information or pieces of information that you came across in your work that you thought were at odds with what was coming out in the mainstream media. And that shocked you. Obviously, as I say, don't feel you have to give any details about that, but could you describe anything about that?
I was working in a high security compound. I had access to top secret intelligence reports on a daily basis. I won't talk about the nature of those reports, but what I would say is that reviewing those top secret intelligence reports about what was happening and then comparing that to what the media was talking about was really what kind of burst the bubble in my head about mainstream news. They just simply didn't match. All of them were lying. And it wasn't just Fox or just CNN or just ABC. It was the full list. I would flip from channel to channel and see what are all these different news outlets reporting, and including the BBC and Al Jazeera and RT and all of them. They were all lying. They were all spinning whatever. And what interested me most, right, I was expecting that they would be all spinning the story in minor ways to fit their own individual narrative. Uh-huh. And while that was somewhat true, at the same time, the larger underlying narrative they were all in agreement on, and it was fabrication and lies as well. And that's what really caught my attention. I thought, wait a second here. They're all in agreement on the base assumptions about this story, and it's a lie. It's not true. And so I started really seeking out, well, is there anybody who's telling the truth? That was what led me to discovering the Corbett Report, James Corbett, and his analysis. And I just found his analysis so intelligent and clear. And I love that he uses this open source journalism. So I became a big fan of James back in those days, and I still follow him closely.
Yes, he's a great journalist indeed. All right, so you have this strange sort of thing going on, and that you're career is taking off at this time, and also this sort of hobby you have, which has turned into you becoming very successful with that as well. So on the surface of your life, you're highly successful, and the troubles of being in the war zone, that's behind you. And yet your world is being now questioned by these strange experiences. You have this discontinuity between the media presentations, which is affecting so many people in the world, and yet the information that's underneath your nose. How did you deal with that psychologically, spiritually?
So we're talking 2010, 2011. So I'm 31 years old. And I think that's an interesting time, right? We look at the life of Jesus, right? And he started his ministry around the same age. And I think in Jewish culture, they look at a certain sort of maturation that's happening in the 30 to 33 year timeframe. And this hits me at around the same time. And what that manifests itself in is I start questioning everything. What do I believe? And is it true? You know, I call myself a Christian, but I have so many questions about my faith. Is it correct? Am I on the right track? Or am I following cleverly devised fables, as the Gospels tell us, right?
That's really interesting. So you hit that point of saying, oh, is everything a lie? Which, I mean, I get people sending me emails, you know, they come across the, as in inverted commas, the truth movement. They start asking these questions and they find themselves going down, severely down the rabbit hole. A lot of people obviously come back from that and have a more rounded worldview after a while. But there is this initial point where a lot of people go straight down that rabbit hole and they say, isn't everything lies? It's all lies.
Yeah.
And of course, that doesn't make sense to say everything is lies, but I can see how, you know, that psychological trap is there for people. So you seem to be having that kind of experience.
Absolutely. Hmm. From a spiritual perspective, I was introduced to the New Atheist movement. Uh-huh. And from a worldly perspective, again, 2008, when I won the world championship in computer overclocking, that was right in the midst of the housing market crash and the stock market troubles and the bailouts that happened.
Yep.
And I was 100% oblivious to all that stuff. I didn't even realize that it was happening because I was so focused on my bubble of my hobby and my career and whatever else. And so the following year timeframe, I had coworkers that were paying attention to all the market mayhem and the beginnings of the Great Recession, as it were. And they kind of introduced me to those ideas. And I remember coming in on a Glenn Beck episode when he was still back at Fox. And he was talking about the national debt and he had the debt clock up. Now, I didn't watch Glenn Beck on a regular basis, but as my coworkers were watching the last 10 minutes of the show and he was describing what it was, and he kind of talked about it in the sense of, imagine you had a credit card and that was maxed out, but you couldn't afford to pay it down. So you got another credit card to pay it down. And he used that as a metaphor to look at the national debt and how it kept growing and growing. And at that time, it was only $13 trillion. I say only.
Oh, crumbs, yeah.
And of course, now, you know, we fast forward 10 years to 2020 or whatever, and we see the government printing trillions of dollars in a go to keep this thing afloat. Mm-hmm. And that kind of rocked me a little bit, too. So it was a kind of... Yeah, exactly what you just described, you know, starting to question everything and wondering what is correct, what's the truth. So on the spiritual side, I discovered the whole field of Christian apologetics, and specifically Dr. William Lane Craig had a major influence on me. And as I dug in and dove in and started trying to understand his extensive work in that area, I just found so many answers to those questions that I had. Really solidified and helped me clarify what is it that I believe and is it correct, and really strengthened my faith in that time.
Yes, I gained a great deal as well from listening to him and reading his books. Because he takes on so many questions head on, doesn't he? He doesn't shy away from things. He's analytical philosopher and a Christian at the same time. Is a wonderful voice to have there in the media. Yes, owe him a lot, actually.
Agreed.
Yeah. So you were pulling back with these apologetical resources, which is great to hear. But you've got another disruption that happens in your life, which is the 2011 earthquake. You're there in Japan when this happens. How did this affect you?
Yeah, so the immediate reaction was non-substantial. Hmm. You know, from my experience on the ground, it was just another earthquake. There was lots of earthquakes in Japan. This one was significant because it was so long. The duration of the earthquake was nearly 5 minutes. So I knew it was a big earthquake, but I didn't know how big. I was 200 miles away from the epicenter, so I've been through many earthquakes in the past, and it felt to me like a 5 or a 6.
Okay, and this wasn't the big one with the tsunami, was it?
No, this was the big one with the tsunami.
Okay.
March 11th, 2011. So the immediate reaction was pretty nonchalant, I would say. However, as I learned of the destruction of the tsunami, now I was on the West Coast, and the tsunami destroyed the East Coast of Japan. Hmm. So in the months following, as we learned about the destruction the tsunami caused and whatnot, the ministry that I was involved in, we mobilized and we got active when we went out to the coast on several occasions and did outreach, and we fed the people there that were struggling. We went and did barbecues, or on hot days, we'd go and mix up smoothies with a blender and whatever, and just talk to the people and give them material support with Bibles and try to reach out to them with the love of Christ as they're in despair. And that experience was quite profound to me, to see people that had just dealt with such a massive disruption, so many lives lost, the destruction of entire villages, all the infrastructure that they had worked so hard for. Mm. And if I could talk about one instance in particular, a village called Taro.
Ah, yes, Taro's Wall. I wonder what this was going to be. Yeah, so this is a village.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. A village on the coast, a little inlet. And it wasn't their first experience with a tsunami on the east coast of Japan. The last time that they had a tsunami in that area was back in the 1930s. Right. And at that time, they had 25,000 roughly residents in Taro. In the 1930s, and more than 80% of them died.
Oh, I see.
So the leftovers in Taro, the leaders of the village that survived, they said, we can never allow this to happen again. And they set to a massive infrastructure project where they built a seawall enclosing and encircling the village area where they intended to rebuild. And it was a project that spanned, I think, more than two decades. And the wall was 10 meters tall, or about 33 feet up from sea level. And they finished the wall sometime in the 1950s. And then later they expanded on it and made a second layer of it. So it was ended up being a double layer wall.
Wow.
And I went and visited Tado 3 months after the tsunami, and the wall was still standing. The inner wall, the outer wall had been destroyed, but the inner wall was still standing. And I walked along that wall with my wife and my children, and we surveyed the damage on the exterior and the interior of the wall. The waves were so large, they just went right over the wall. Eyewitnesses say at least 10, maybe 15 feet higher than the wall.
Oh, I see.
The waves dumped right over it, and it destroyed the entire village again. And as I walked along that wall and I thought about this massive disruption that these people faced, and then I thought about the idea that they had built this wall to prevent this from ever happening again, a light came on in my spirit, and I thought, wow, as hard as we try, we're not in control, you know? That planted a seed in my spirit, and I started thinking about what types of walls am I building in my own life that I think are going to protect or save me, and yet I'm discounting the idea that the Lord's in control in doing so. Mm. And what those walls really are idols. And so the Lord really convicted me that I've set up idols in my heart, right. Things that he has told us that he's going to be our source. Yet I've got these other things that I'm looking to. They're counterfeits of Christ's promise to us of joy, of peace, of healing, of supply. You know what I mean? And I'm thinking about this career that I've built, this notoriety that I've gained from the overclocking experience. My 401k, my medical insurance, none of these things in and of themselves are evil or bad. Rather, it was my heart's position towards them and how they were stealing away the honor and the glory and the majesty of my Lord.
And yes, I think I get the picture here. So you're not saying it's wrong for us ever to protect ourselves in any way at all. Because, I mean, later on, you're going to be talking about various ways that we should prepare, indeed even physically prepare for disruptions in our lives. But it seems to me you're talking about the problem of setting up ultimate protections, which are, as you say, idolatrous, putting those in the way of God, putting those in the place that he should be having in our lives. That's what you mean.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So this had an enormous effect upon you, caused you to rethink your life dramatically, and you ended up in Belize. How did that happen? I mean, why Belize? Obviously, you felt sort of called to go there, but you have to tell us something about that because, that's a big question for me. Why there?
Sure. Yeah. So back in 2010, 2011, as I'm having this search for truth, and my wife and I are almost on the same page. At the same time, I was having some health issues lingering from Iraq. We were trying different remedies, and I was for the first time experimenting with natural remedies instead of pharmaceuticals. What I'm saying is that my wife and I were kind of on this journey together. It's wonderful when you can be on the same page as your spouse. I have friends and colleagues that maybe they're hip to seeking truth, but their spouse is not. And that's always a frustrating situation. Mm. But my wife and I had for a long time talked about what about having a vacation home in Central or South America somewhere. My wife ethnically is Mexican. Her parents are both Mexican. Oh. And so we had looked at Mexico quite a bit.
And Belize is just across the border, isn't it, from Mexico? Is that right?
That's right. They share one border. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. So why Belize? Well, as we were praying for guidance, I started to feel, what if the Lord just wants us to go and live a different life, a ministry-focused life? And what does that look like? And where are the needs? And where are our skills best matched? And I felt inadequate and incapable of ministry within America. I say that because of those temptations in my heart and those idols that I personally was struggling with, right?
Right.
I felt like a cultural change was appropriate for me so that I could kind of separate myself from the world. I don't mean the world physically, I mean, spiritually, separate myself from those temptations and those idols that the Lord had convicted me of.
So like the typical sort of first world success things, that's career right. and nice car. And
that's right.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. Okay. So I kind of posed it to my wife, what if we're not supposed to have a vacation home down south, but we're just supposed to simply relocate there? And so we started praying diligently, daily. And that started shortly after the earthquake and tsunami in 2011 until we left Japan in 2013. The Lord had opened doors and allowed us to transition back to Seattle, Washington, where we call home. Most of our family is still in the Seattle area. Had some time in Seattle to kind of reevaluate, are we supposed to stay in America? And I think the Lord very quickly urged me, no, keep moving. This is just a temporary stop here. And we had surveyed online many different Central and South American countries, Mexico, Panama, Costa Rica, Belize one time, then down to Chile and Argentina and Uruguay, or Uruguay as most Americans would say it. Now, the first time we looked at Belize, we just saw the touristy shots online and we scraped over it pretty quickly. I thought, I don't want to be around just a partyville, so to speak. Touristy areas are not the type of life I was thinking about. I was thinking about being around more the indigenous people and figuring out how to minister to them. We had thought about partaking in orphanage ministries or getting involved in the human trafficking problem and seeing how we could be a help to those particular ministries. But the second time we came around to Belize, we discovered the Cayo District. And the Cayo District is kind of the inland, more jungle area. Of course, Belize is an English-speaking country. Mm. It's the only English-speaking country in Central and South America. And since I'm not fluent in Spanish, my wife is, but my Spanish is enough to help me get around on the street, but not enough to do business.
And there's quite a lot of Spanish spoken there too, isn't there?
Yes, quite a bit. Mm. So Belize had a great appeal in that way. And then we started, we had been researching already intentional communities where other Americans with kind of a like mindset were settling. And we found one in Belize and we came down and visited, and my wife was skeptical. I was a bit overeager maybe, but I trusted the Lord to speak through my wife. And after we came down and visited, she had a peace about it. Again, we were still praying diligently daily. So after she felt the Lord's peace, we picked up everything and sold almost everything we had and packed up the rest in a pickup truck and cargo trailer and drove down to Florida and landed in Belize in 2014.
Well, tell me what this intentional community is. I've not heard that phrase before.
Intentional community. So, think of like a Mennonite or a Amish community, close-knit. They work together and try to help one another.
Right.
So this concept, but without the religious rules, the legalism you would associate with a Mennonite or Amish community. And there's intentional communities popping up all over the world. Maybe something for you to look into in a future.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think I get the idea. I just am not familiar with that phrase. I shall note it down now.
They're generally very unsuccessful because people are usually looking for a utopia.
Right.
And when they don't find it, the concept falls apart. Yeah, I don't think this one has had as much success as we originally envisioned, but it's working. We get along well with our neighbors, and it's been a good experience. So we did end up moving into this intentional community.
And you are a Christian entrepreneur, you say, and your English speaking helped you to do business. So what kind of business are you doing there?
So quite a few different things. When I first hit the ground, I thought I would try to develop a market for my IT skills. Mm. But Belize is a young developing nation, and I quickly realized that the IT skills that I had were much too high level for any client here in Belize, except for the government or the big crony businesses that I didn't really have any interest in working with. So I had to very quickly readjust my thinking and come up with another idea. And when we moved down here, the community that we moved into is off-grid, and I brought down a large solar system and installed it at my house. And then I looked around in Belize and I said, man, there's just a massive opportunity for solar here. So I started a solar business. And to this day, I sell and install solar equipment. Ah, but in addition to that, they say in Belize that you can't only stick to one thing. The population and the economy is too small. You have to be more of a jack of all trades. And we live very close to a modern Mennonite colony, around 2,500 population. And some of the biggest businesses in Belize are headquartered out of this Mennonite colony. And as I've developed personal relationships within the community, I've had several of the business owners in the colony approach me directly and ask me if I would help them improve their businesses, restructure or whatever. And so I have gotten into consulting, business management and governance and high level consulting. And that's been a fascinating journey in and of itself.
And is there an overlap between your entrepreneurial work and your Christian ministry? Again, in the one of the videos of yours that I saw you, and this is about a year ago, of course, you say that there are some difficulties that you're having in Belize, but you feel that you're called to be, and this is a phrase that a lot of Christians use, to be Jesus' hands and feet in that situation. Which obviously is metaphorical language to point to the way in which the Spirit of God was moving within Jesus. So, you know, in a way that's obviously we're not him, we're not Jesus, but there's a sort of parallel way in which the Spirit of God can help us to do the kinds of works that Jesus would be doing here were he here in his, you know, his body these days. That's the kind of thinking behind that phrase. So, you know, it's a way of talking about specifically Christian ministry. Is there an overlap between your entrepreneur work and Christian ministry?
Very much. 2.5 years after I arrived here, I discovered a ministry here called Trades for Life. Their website's www.trades4life.bz. An awesome ministry that's focused on trades training for the young men in Belize. And so starting in 2017, I got involved with Trades for Life and I started teaching once a year their computer class. And that school is very intentionally Christian-based and faith-based. In the morning and in the evening, we do devotions and do life skills training and talk about what it means to be Christians in the world today, in our families and in the workplace and handling our money and so on and so forth. I train there once a year. We do a 6-week workshop. Just an awesome opportunity.
So looking back over all this journey that you've been on over these years, you can very much see the hand of God in what's happened through all these disruptions, as we'll come on to talk about in a minute. It's very clear to you that this has been God's journey, not just a sort of random collection of events.
I'm often shook by how much that is true. I'm overwhelmed sometimes. The places that God puts me, the people that he sits me down in front of to give me an opportunity to strengthen or encourage or lament with individuals dealing with disruption, and then to share a little bit of my testimony that, look, God has a bigger plan and we can trust him so completely. And even through the disruption, he's going to help you grow. And when you persist and lean on him as your source, he will carry you through the disruption, and that will also prepare you for the next disruption.
Okay. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this concept of prepping that you have? And when people, when I hear the term prepping, I tend to think, of course, of the classic prepper who fills their garage with all kinds of dry goods and the like, waiting for the great calamity to hit, and they're going to be okay for the next 6 months. So they've got a garage full of pasta or whatever it is. Now, that's a very small aspect of the kind of thing I think you're going to talk about. But you do mention all kinds of different prepping, to use that phrase, which I think comes out of this deep sense that you have now that so many of us have a kind of an illusion of peace in this world, an illusion of stability, and we ought really to sort of grow up and realize that anything can happen. There are disruptions that can happen in all kinds of ways that you've been describing. You've had a catalogue of disruptions in your life that you've come through. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell us a bit about these preparations? It's not just pasta in the garage, is it?
Well, that certainly influenced me back when I learned about the economic disruptions that we faced in 2008 and 2009, the effects of which are still felt within our economy when you look at the numbers, right? There was lots of voices that I went to that talked about this physical preparation and the idea of storing up food or that sort of thing.
Yeah, and absolutely. I don't want to speak against that and sort of ridicule that. I was using that as an example and the fact that we tend to think exclusively of that. And in fact, you know, back, I don't know whether you remember Y2K, we called the Millennium Bug, wasn't it? You know, where there was the idea that all these computers had the wrong date and they were all going to shut off and that sort of thing. And of course, a lot of work was done, I understand, to prevent a catastrophe that might have happened. Of course, it wasn't as bad as people thought. But anyway, in the months leading up to that, I was listening to Dr. Stanley Monteith, particularly on Radio Liberty, and, you know, there were messages coming out about making sure you've got some food stacked away. And I thought, well, you know, if the world comes to an end, there's nothing I can do. But, you know, if I can't get into the supermarket to, you know, I can't find any food on the shelves for a month, then would it be really stupid of me not to have made some kind of preparations? That's what I did. I got a couple of big cardboard boxes and bought that kind of food. Now, as it happened, I didn't need that. But I think it would have been foolish not to have made a minimal preparation like that. So I'm not against the idea at all. It's interesting that I have spoken to people, even in Christian circles, since those days, and there's a sort of chuckle that people have, you know, when I mention this. And I do think, it's so easy to be complacent that, you know, it didn't happen. We can think that nothing like that would ever happen, but there's something to be said for making a sensible preparation. So anyway, I just wanted to make it clear that I take some of that advice myself in a minimal way.
Well, I do too. And I agree with everything that you just said, Julian. I think that's absolutely spot on. But I think there's a lot more to it. My idea of preparation has gone far beyond just that physical preparation. First of all, I would want to prepare mentally. Going back to a time of war, so to speak, we're constantly drilling, mentally speaking, that we need to be prepared for the ambush, right? You know, my upbringing, my raising, I wasn't expecting disruption, so to speak. So mentally, I was never prepared for anything like that. And I think the Lord really was working in my mind during the Iraq war that this idea of mentally preparing is important. And I think it's something that the Word teaches too. In John chapter 15, Jesus talks about the world hating us. And if we belong to the world, we'd love it as our own. But we don't belong to the world. Or in John 16, I've told you these things that you may have peace. In this world, you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world, right? A very well-known passage. Anyway, we look at some of these passages in the Word, and they're telling us, look, things will come. We should expect them. And so there's a certain amount of mental preparation that we need to have. And that complacency that you mention, I think, is infectious, right? Yeah. We kind of take a glib, complacent attitude because we see people prepping and then not needing to. And so we think, well, if it didn't happen this time, it won't happen next time. But when you talk to people who have been through a major disruption, many of them were not prepared, and it shows right afterward. They're just so overwhelmed and so, I mean, it really, people struggle to make it through. You know, the epidemic of suicide after the tsunami and earthquake in Japan was massive. So many people taking their own life because they just had this despair. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that they were not mentally prepared for anything like that to happen, even though all up and down the coast, they had early warning signs, and you drive down the road and you see says tsunami evacuation route and all the signs pointing you toward the shelters and so on and so forth. You know, it had been ingrained in their society that this could happen one day, and yet mentally, most of them were not prepared for it.
It's really interesting because I think that people can forget as well after so many decades, because, you know, in my experience, some of the people who are would actually be most resistant to the kind of thing that I was just talking about in my little anecdote were quite elderly people who themselves had been through the Second World War period.
Right.
But it was such a long time ago, and the world's so different now, and that sort of complacency can set in and they can lose the memory and behave quite differently now from how they would have done. And that goes for all of us. I'm sure we can all forget such things and forget the lessons we might have learned. So yeah, I can see what you mean in that sense of expectation. We should all at least live with the very real expectation that something might well happen that can disrupt us severely, which is not to live with downturn mouth all the time and to be miserable, anything but. But as you say, we shouldn't live with an illusion, should we? An illusion of peace and stability as if nothing could ever go wrong.
That's right. I think that's become much more real to a lot of people over this past year, right?
Absolutely. Although I think one of the illusions that a lot of people have is that we're turning the corner and we're all going to come out of this. Even though we constantly said, oh, it's just a few more weeks, a few more months until we're out of this, and then it carries on and on. But nevertheless, there's still this narrative in the media, the mainstream media, that the roadmap is there, we're going to come out. And I'm thinking, we've got to be prepared for this to be not just to drag on, but to be dragged on by various vested interests that want this to drag on. We shouldn't kid ourselves that it all is going to be over soon. You know, there are dark forces out there, and we must be prepared to live with that reality however we can.
Absolutely, yeah. So the second stage of prepping in my mind is physical prepping. So we talked about mental prepping, and then before we were mentioning the physical prepping. And this one, there's obviously a lot of controversy over, because we have scriptures like Matthew 6, Sermon on the Mount, where Christ said, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal." Mm. And yet we have other scriptures that seem to potentially contradict them. Proverbs 27:12, "The prudent see danger and take refuge, but the simple keep on going and pay the penalty." Mm. Or Proverbs 6:6 about the ant, right? Go to the ant, you sluggard, consider its ways and be wise. Mm. So when I was doing a lot of studying on these particular topics and thinking about these things, when we moved to Belize and we were doing some of this physical prepping, you know, being off grid and growing a garden and storing away food and that sort of thing, I thought, well, I'm being like the ant. And then I go to Matthew 6 and it seems like, well, Jesus told us not to do these things. How do we make sense out of this? And I really found revelation when I got to this word treasures.
Yes.
Jesus' word says, "Do not store for yourself treasures on earth." Mm. It became very clear to me when I meditated on that a little bit to understand that preparations can be treasures. And that's where the danger would lie. But preparations don't have to be treasures. They can just be prudent reactions to potential danger. Mm. And so I would take this on an individual basis, right? And I think it has to do with your own personal relationship with Christ. You have to make sure that your trust is in him, but you're being prepared and being prudent with your physical actions. Have physical preparations. Just don't allow those things to become a treasure or a counterfeit source of peace. Christ is our peace. He's our source of peace. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, the sense of the word treasure there is what your heart desires most, isn't it? I mean, if we just continue the rest of that passage. So this is Matthew 6:19, but let's go on to 21. So as you say, what am I reading here? This is the King James Version, but why not? "Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." That's the key, isn't it? It's where your heart is, the center of your attention and your devotion. Whatever that is, that's your treasure. So if you make that the things of this world, then you're setting yourself up for a fall.
Yeah. And there's a promise that follows shortly after that where Christ says he knows what we need and he's going to provide. And that's obviously also a very well-known scripture. But take that to heart, you know. And I think if you are storing up for yourselves and then you find bugs in it a year or two later, I just recently had that experience. We pulled out some of our stored food and discovered some of the beans had spoiled. They hadn't been properly sealed. And my reaction was, c'est la vie, right? They're not my treasure, right? Christ is going to provide for us. I'm doing the best I can to be prudent and make preparations, but he knows what I need. Yeah. And those bags of beans under my house are not my treasure.
It might be stronger than c'est la vie, but I get your meaning. When you actually pull back the tarpaulin, c'est la vie. Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, I know what you mean.
So the third is spiritual prepping. I've alluded to this many times, but the idea that Christ is our only real, authentic source, and specifically, I want to say, our source of hope and joy and peace. Those are things that he's promised to be, and we have to, I think, take that seriously. So red flags for me, in other words, warning signs that maybe I'm not in the correct mindset spiritually, is when I start getting hope or joy or peace from other things. And so I always take a step back and I think, man, are these things becoming an idol to me or not? I'm constantly reevaluating the things in my life and thinking about what is becoming a counterfeit source of the things that Christ has promised to be for us. Then the other thing is trust, right? We trust him. Some of the scriptures that have really hit me, 1 John 2, where he talks, do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in them. Everything of the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, right?
Yes, that defines it, doesn't it? Because people can often think world, that means not anything in the world at all. Didn't God make the world? Isn't it God's universe? Yeah, but no, that's not what it means. It's a particular theological term, isn't it? A very Johannine, a very John term, the world. And that's the definition, isn't it? It's the lust of the flesh, it's the lust of the eyes, it's the pride of life. It's the excess, isn't it? It's not taking things as created things to be used with God's wisdom, but just to be exploited. And we have a tendency to do that and put those things first in our life. It's the system of the world, isn't it? It's the worldly system.
That's right.
Within us as well. The tendencies we have within ourselves to conform to that system.
Well, that's right. And one of the scriptures that really hit me hard and convicted me back when the whole earthquake and tsunami thing happened and I saw the wall in Taro was the parable of the sower. And when he threw the seeds along the path and some of them fell on this and some of them fell on that, we look at the description of the thorny soil. And the thorny soil is when the allure of the things of this world become too great, those thorns choke out the word that was planted in us. And man, that hit me like a ton of bricks when I studied that back in this time frame. And I thought, I was a seed planted among the thorns. And I think to a certain degree, all of us are, right? The lust of wealth and that sort of thing. And so I think the Lord really used that scripture to help me understand that my faith, my trust was not in Christ well enough, that I was taking the forbidden fruit, so to speak, that Satan offered to Eve, right? You can be like God, knowing good and evil. And I was trying to do that myself, right? Choose for myself and not trust in him. And so understanding that he is our source.
And at the beginning of what you said about this, about that's very real. I mean, this can sound very sort of theoretical, but actually there's something that I often come back to with this. I read a book by Richard Wurmbrand. This is many, many years ago. The Romanian pastor was persecuted during the communist era. He was shut away in prison for donkey's years. He put in solitary confinement in a sort of box room with no light and all that sort of thing. Absolutely horrendous experiences he had. But the experience of Christ to him was very real. You know, obviously, I hope and pray that I will never, and I'm very unlikely to experience anything like what he experienced. But it's just that very reality of it for him encourages me to realize that the experience of Christ can be real in my own life as well, in no doubt in lesser ways than that. But I mean, he was shut away and he would compose sermons inside his mind, you know, and remember many of them when he came out, hundreds of them. And he said that he had the most glorious experiences of the Spirit when he was in that situation. I mean, that's incredible. Mm-hmm. God was actually communicating with him in ways that were beyond his wildest dreams when his captors were persecuting him in the most dreadful, isolated situation. He was there communing with the God of the universe. I mean, it's extraordinary. So when you say this is real, yes, it is real, but we need to be attuned to this. We need to, as you're saying, we need to prep for this, you know. So yeah, we can experience him.
Yeah. So the spiritual prepping is relationship, really. That's what it boils down
yes.
to.
Yes.
Being in the Word and seeking the Father and praying to him and speaking to him and
yes.
and that sort of thing. Mm. You know, I grew up reading the Word or praying as a religious duty. Mm. That doesn't work.
No, that's right.
It goes back to the Matthew 6 verse that you just pointed out. It's about our heart, right? intimate relationship with the Lord. So if you listening, don't experience that, get in the Word more, pray more, seek the Lord. He will make himself known to you in one way or another, right?
Yeah, I totally agree with what you say, not taking this as a duty, but as a means of communication. And then, this is what I do, not as much as I should, but practice the presence of God. It sounds such a dry phrase, but in my experience, it literally is just stopping all the chaos going on in my mind, the worries, the fears, just stopping and perhaps even focusing on something beautiful outside, like a tree in the sun over there, and just saying, this is God's creation, and God is here. He is here now. And there are so many times when I just stop myself and think in those terms. It's as if a different worldview passes across my mind, and I am aware of his presence. You know, you have to just stop yourself, don't you, sometimes, and do that as an act of the will. And certainly in my life, the more I've done that, the seasons when I've done that, more I feel closer to him.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a choice.
Yeah.
Which worldview do we want to live within?
Absolutely. Yeah, I guess the other point on that I would make would be that in poverty or in wealth, I think our posture doesn't change, spiritually speaking.
Yes.
You know, the temptation for me has always been when something's not going according to my plan, then I'm on my knees crying out to the Lord. Right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And I think we have to take that seriously. Like, you know, I look at Revelation 3:17, one of the letters to the churches, it says, "You say, I am rich, I have acquired wealth and do not need a thing. But you do not realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked." And I just think, you know, even in those times in your life when you feel like you've made it, you've got it, you don't need,
absolutely,
never forget that you you need him.
Well, anecdote time. I've probably shared this before, but this is donkeys years ago. I shocked myself at one point. It was just one point in, I was writing music. I've been writing music just for a few years. And, you know, there was a time when I had a little bit of success by my standards. You know, I was getting performances, commissions and things like that. And I got rather sort of satisfied with myself. And I remember sitting at my desk where I used to write music. And this was just at that moment when I thought I was doing quite well, you know. And I remember thinking, it was a thought that just passed across my mind, almost as if I didn't think it, which is quite interesting. And the thought was this: I don't need God anymore. How about that? Mm-hmm. Those are exactly the words: I don't need God anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, immediately I was shocked by that thought. You know, where did that come from? You know, but I was aware that it was because I thought I was being successful at the time that, okay, I didn't need to rest on anyone else. You know, I didn't even need to acknowledge my creatureliness in that moment. That's lived with me ever since as a pitfall that I could fall into. All of us suffer from this tendency. We have to rest on him. We should never allow ourselves to be kidded into anything else, because, you know, we are creatures at the end of the day.
Amen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of the last bit for me is just the emotional side. And I feel like, our emotions are driven so much by these other three areas, right? The Lord has given us emotions, and yet we're encouraged to express certain emotions and to not express others. I have come to the understanding that I think the enemy, Satan, he really likes to deceive us through emotions.
Yes.
And so I think getting our preparations correct so that we can be in control of our emotional state is so important.
Indeed it is, very much so. And that actually reminds me of the name of my podcast, as it happens. You know, The Mind Renewed. It's the quotation from Paul upon which that is based. You know, the renewing of your mind, and that sense of the mind in control, not the emotions in control. I mean, emotions are useful, but they shouldn't be in control. It should be the mind as informed by Christ in control.
Yeah. Yeah, so Christ and the Word tells us that the Lord is coming back for a spotless bride. And I take those instructions very seriously. I had a friend recently ask me, what would you say to the hundreds of thousands of people that have come before you over the past few centuries, millenniums, who have said, oh, well, Christ is coming back, it's imminent, it'll be any time, right?
Mm.
And I've heard that question before, but my response to him was, well, generally speaking, I think they were right.
Yeah, exactly right. Yes, indeed. I've had this with preaching as well. When I preach on such a topic and people will say similar things, and I say, well, yeah, they were right to do so in their time, and it just so happened that it didn't happen then. Doesn't mean they were wrong.
Right. Well,
they were right to have that expectation. They would have been wrong if they said it's definitely going to be next Tuesday at 4 o'clock. But if they're just expecting, it could well be within our lifetime, well, they've done the right thing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're not supposed to set dates, right? And yes. Obviously we can look back and point at specific examples. But if we speak generally about the thousands that have come before us that said, Christ is coming back anytime and I'm excited about it, that's how I want to live my life, right? Mm. That's how we were exhorted to live.
Yeah.
We look at the parable of the 10 virgins, and that's been so influential to me, thinking about keeping your oil full. Mm. And I think that's referring to what I was talking about earlier with spiritual prepping. We need to be close to the Lord. We need to have the Holy Spirit in us and informing us and giving us wisdom and insight and discernment about the things that we face in each of our daily lives. Mm. And in doing so, our oil is kept full and we will be excited for Christ's return. And when he comes, we're not going to miss it. Our vessels aren't going to be empty, so to speak.
Yes, does what you're saying here connect with what you talk about, a lifestyle of fasting? That can sound very austere. I mean, fasting itself sounds like a really austere thing to do. I mean, I can't say that I fast an awful lot, but then, you know, I do sometimes. And apart from it being good for one's health, I have found at times that it does help me in my relationship with God, because there is that sense of feeling a little bit more detached from things around me, and more attached to a sort of inward sense of communion with God, if that makes sense. But I mean, you're talking about a lifestyle of fasting, and that can sound incredibly austere, as if you're saying, well, basically we shouldn't have very much to eat for the rest of our lives. I guess you don't mean that. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I haven't heard anyone teaching so much about this, but for me, the revelation that the Lord gave me on this is just that fasting is a form of spiritual preparation for deception. And what I mean by that, going back to that scripture from 1 John chapter 2, loving the world, I think our flesh is at odds with the spirit in so many ways. And I think the physical fasting from food, from eating, is simply a practice of denying the flesh so that we can be focused on feeding the spirit. And I think we can live a lifestyle of this same principle, fasting from the flesh. Mm. I guess the revelation that the Lord gave me is when I came to Belize and I turned my back on my flesh desires, I realized that it in itself was a form of fasting from gratifying my flesh. Does that make sense?
I think so. Right. So the deep need to be successful in the world's terms, the deep need to have things that would be status symbols, those sorts of deep-seated needs, which quite honestly shouldn't be. But that's the way we seem to be constituted, which is not to say any of those things are in themselves completely wrong, but they can occupy the wrong place in our lives. Is that the kind of thing you mean, to be free from those as deep-seated claws in our soul?
Absolutely, because I think that the enemy likes to use those things as a deception, as a manipulation in our minds and in our spirits, that we get focused on those things and then aren't able to keep our oil filled in our jars from a spiritual perspective, right? Mm. It's a deception that the enemy uses to keep us away from authentic relationship with Christ. And so a lifestyle of fasting is understanding what is it in my flesh. And it's different for each individual. And that's why you say what you just said about it doesn't mean these things in and of themselves are necessarily wrong. Mm. It's rather identifying what is it that is wrong for you. What is a temptation of your flesh that is preventing you from being filled spiritually and fasting from those things?
Absolutely. So yes, indeed, a lifestyle of fasting, not a lifestyle of total self-denial. So, I mean, to shift it from food to going back to, say, a livelihood, it's not that we shouldn't work at all. But if your particular thing is to have this high-flying career and that is standing in the way of your relationship with God, then that's an area of your life that you're going to need to subject to this fasting so that it isn't that central thing in your life. But it doesn't mean you're not going to work for a living. You're not just going to walk around the countryside being a burden on other people.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
I think years ago, actually, the beginning of the podcast, I had a little experimentation with a couple of sermons online. I was never quite happy about how to do that, so I only did two of them. And one of them was called Holding Things Lightly. And it was a similar sort of idea that I was just going with there. There was a guy called Brian Austin years ago, influenced me, ran a Christian bookshop in London. And he was speaking to me in those terms, really, that we should somehow try to hold all of the things in our lives with a certain light touch.
Mm-hmm.
Because disruptions come along, to use the word that you speak about, and things can go terribly wrong. And if we are deeply invested in these things, we're going to go down too with the ship, as it were, you know. So, but if we're holding on lightly to those things because we're really holding on to God tightly,
mm-hmm.
then we won't go down with the ship. It's a very simple idea, but I've always found that really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to connect with the kinds of things that you're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's right on the mark, what I'm getting at. And I think that's countercultural in the American context, certainly. And I think the same in Europe, right? But I think the Christian church has always been countercultural. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a good
thing. At its best. Maybe not at its worst.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, well, when we say the Christian church, we're not talking about the institutions necessarily, are we? Which can go way off mark. But
Yeah, thank you for that clarification.
Christ's people, at our best, can model this, indeed. Well, what an interesting conversation. A helpful conversation for me, and I certainly hope it's been helpful for other people listening. You know, I haven't had a conversation like this for quite some time. There have been a few of them during the history of the podcast. I'm thinking of actually John Thompson, that interview way back, gosh, about his book, Jesus, Bread and Chocolate. It was a similar sort of conversation. It is good, I think, to have this kind of talk every now and again to certainly to remind me of the main reason why I'm doing the podcast, to put things in a spiritual context, in a faith context. It's very easy to look at the troubles in the world and just get overburdened by them. And I think actually during the pandemic time, I've tended to do that. I have been rather weighed down by it, as so many people, of course, have been, and taken my eyes off God. That sounds over the top, you know, as if I've become an atheist. No, I don't mean that at all. But to be more concerned about the stuff that's going on and what might happen in future, instead of thinking, no, just a moment, my peace is in the God of the universe. Why am I so worried? Why am I so concerned?
Mm-hmm.
He is ultimately in charge. So thank you for a conversation like this. Whether it's been helpful to other people, I don't know, but I do hope so. It's been helpful to me, and I thank you very much for sharing quite intimate things with us. Thanks for offering to come on. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Julian. It's been such a pleasure. I really appreciate the work that you've been doing, and I'll continue to be a listener for quite some time, I'm sure, as long as you're doing it. Just as an encouragement to those listening, thank you for joining us today. And the Lord is coming. And just in reflection on this past year, as we draw nearer to his return, we should expect more shakings. Mm. The Lord is preparing us. And if you desire to be part of that spotless bride, think about these things that we've talked about as far as this prepping mentally and physically, and most importantly, spiritually. That you have your oil filled and you are part of that bride. And that comes through intimate and real relationship with Christ.
Absolutely. Thank you for concluding in that way. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. Can I just draw people's attention to the fact that you do have this vlog? I mentioned it a few times. You're not terribly active on it, are you? But you do have some talks that you put up there. People might be interested to hear those. Is it Joy Vlog?
That's right, Joy Vlog.
On BitChute. Is it anywhere else, or is it just BitChute at the moment?
It's also on YouTube, but I don't like sending people there, so go to BitChute.
Yes, I totally agree with you. Yeah, okay. I'll put that in the show notes. Thanks very much.
Yeah, and I'll just say that I started that during the early days of the pandemic and the lockdown, not sure how long the lockdowns would last. And I have not been active on it because here in Belize, the lockdowns didn't last very long. But I do intend to pick that back up if time allows in the future.
I'm sure people will be interested to check that out, so I will put that in the show notes. Great. Thanks very much for coming on. I've enjoyed it enormously. Hope to speak to you again one day.
Thank you.